You are now listening to the Build a Brain podcast with Dr. Jeannie Zayer. Join the quest to shape an efficient brain that fires on all cylinders and runs like a fine-tuned machine. You are now in the capable hands of an international presenter and a pathologically optimistic brain builder. Dr. Zayer will give you the right blocks to build that 3 pounds of cerebral muscle for you, your child, or the young adult you teach or mentor. Block by block, thought by thought, now is the time to build a better brain. Let's get started.
Friends, welcome to Build a Brain, where we listen to wonderful interviews with people that are giants in the Feuerstein world. And as I discovered Feuerstein 25 years ago, I discovered that, oh my goodness, block by block, thought by thought, you can literally build a brain. And so today, my wonderful guest is good friend, colleague, mentor, Dr. Lou Falick. And I'd like to introduce Lou by saying he was one of Reuven's best friends and co-authors. Every time you see a book from the last 30 years, I have them all lined up over there on my shelf. It'll say Reuven Feuerstein, Rafi Feuerstein, and Lou Falick. So here he is in person, my friends. Lou, welcome to Build a Brain.
Thank you. And my great pleasure at being able to participate in this.
Yeah, so good to have you here. Lou introduced me to a book that is called The Gift of Therapy. And Irvin D. Yalom, MD, a doctor, psychiatrist, did an excellent job of just looking back over his lifetime and putting together little short chapters. And Lou said, oh, you got to read this book. So by golly, I did. And I just saw all over it. And this guy, I don't think knows anything about Feuerstein or mediation, but I saw mediation all over it. So one of my favorite quotes was, often the therapist is the only audience viewing great dramas and acts of courage. And I see that with my team here at MindCapaloo, where we are able to say, bravo, good job. We don't use stickers and candy or reward systems, but we certainly recognize that we have clients that have had an act of courage. I bet you've seen that in your lifetime as well.
Absolutely. The learner who is experiencing disabilities or difficulties or needing to overcome genetic or other kinds of physical disabilities comes to the experience, the teaching experience, the learning experience, with a good deal of concern, maybe fear. Yeah. They've organized their lives or they've received all kinds of feedback that tells mm-hmm. them that they can't or won't or are unlikely. And when we approach them from a mediational perspective, using what we know about mediated learning experience and its components, we overcome that fear and we encourage the courage of the learner. And I'm always amazed at how quickly that happens, how quickly the learner joins us in being willing to confront their previous difficulties. Mm-hmm. And it is, from my point of view, a consequence of the aspects of the therapeutic relationship. When I say therapy, I'm not thinking of psychotherapy. I'm not thinking of counseling. I'm thinking of the nature of an intimate interpersonal relationship where both parties share their willingness to confront and the expectation that confrontation will be positive. Mm-hmm. And early evidence, mm-hmm. early interactional evidence that makes that confrontation, transforms that confrontation into, yes, I can do this. Yes, mm-hmm. this will work. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, you understand me. Yes, I understand you.
I would agree that that has surprised me for 25 years, is that a very resistant teenager by the third session suddenly seems to be very engaged. I had it happen today twice. I told you, Lou, I was working at a middle school, mm-hmm. and both my morning class and the afternoon class had a student that goes, I'm not doing dots today. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do it. And they were kind of stomping around the room. And I just kept inviting them. And I'd look at them and say, well, I hope you come join me. And pretty soon, both situations, they came and sat down and did some really excellent work today. That book is, to me, we could change the title of A Gift of Therapy to The Gift of Mediation, mm-hmm. which you brilliantly put together into this book, Integrating Social Cognition into Therapeutic Practice. So for our listeners, I want to read this part that caught my attention right away. The role of interpersonal interaction, which is what you just said, Lou, is that let's don't think about therapy like a psychologist, even though you were a very successful psychologist. And then you discovered Reuven, a bit like I was an educator doing well in my career. But then I discovered Reuven's work and things changed for both of us. So on page 2, you write right away about the role of interpersonal interaction. There's a general consensus in the field of counseling and psychotherapy that it is the nature of the interpersonal relationship that is a more important predictor of positive change than the specific methodological approach of the therapist. Not to say, you go on to talk about how it's not that the methods aren't important, but wow, you saw as you were training young psychologists that there could be something missing. So share, how did you figure out that the something missing was this idea of mediation?
Well, in a very specific way, when I was teaching in the graduate program in counseling psychology, and we would select graduate students for training, we selected the students who seemed to us to be most intuitive and most interpersonally related and so on. And then we began to train them in the traditional ways, in the traditional interviewing skills ways. And many of us, including myself, observed that they were becoming less intuitive. They were becoming more tentative. They were becoming more blocked. And I began to question, where did that kind of open... Yeah. intuitive reaction go? And I concluded that it went away because of the mechanical way in which we mm-hmm. taught interviewing mm-hmm. skills and clinical mm-hmm. insights. Now, that was happening at the same time that I was beginning my intensive work with Professor Feuerstein. And in 1989, we were talking, and Professor Feuerstein said, you know, one of the areas that we have not exploited in the understanding and the explication of mediated learning experience has been its effect on the interpersonal relationships in therapeutic environments. Mm. So I said, well, that's something that interests me greatly, and so let's work on it. And in 1990, we published a paper, the thesis of which was that interpersonal relationships and therapeutic relationships have in them a basic foundation of interactions that are consistent with how we are defining mediated learning experience. Mm. And we wrote that paper in 1990. I didn't do much with it beyond that because of all of the other work that we were developing in the Feuerstein approach. And then when I semi-retired from the Institute and came back to the United States and started going through my files, I put my hand on most of the work that I had done with regard to this area of concern. And actually, I need to correct myself a little bit here. It wasn't that I didn't work on it, but when I was back at the university, I began to develop a curriculum. Taking mediated learning experience parameters and looking at them in relationship to what we know about the mm-hmm. about the processes of developing counseling and therapeutic relationships. And apropos of what the passage you just read, there has been evidence for years and years and years that if you ask clients and patients what was the most important aspect of their progress in their working through their issues, overwhelmingly, they say it was the relationship with the therapist, not the methodological approach. Oh, this worked because it was psychoanalytic. This worked because it was cognitive behavioral. They say the main thing that made a difference was my relationship with my therapist.
Yes.
Did I believe him? Mm-hmm. Did I trust him? Did he understand me? Et cetera, et cetera. And the tools of the therapy, whether you're an analyst or a behaviorist or a narrative therapist or whatever, are important, but they're less important in establishing the potential for change and the feeling of what made that change happen.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Your chapter 3 of the book is all about applying MLE to the therapeutic practice. And you take all 12 of the parameters and do a section on every one of them and how they apply to the counseling session. And here at MindCap, we do the same thing we're constantly talking about this client that we're working with really needs mediated for a sense of competence or challenge, but we're not counselors or doing psychological work, but yet, wow, we're still help somebody's brain work better. Mm-hmm. And isn't that what counselors do too?
Of course. I want to go back to the issue of intuition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your comment about how in the book I outline in great detail the parameters of MLE and how they show themselves in the counseling, therapeutic, interpersonal relationship. Ultimately, it's the intuitive response of the mediator that makes a difference. And there's a kind of, in cognitive functions, we talk about the internalizing of thoughts and feelings. And my experience with both the students I taught and the mediators that I have had an opportunity and a pleasure to work with over the years, when you make a response in a session, in a teaching session, in a learning session, you don't necessarily know at the moment you're making the response, oh, this is why I'm saying this, this is the mediational principle I'm going after, et cetera, et cetera. You do it intuitively.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes sense. And you get a reciprocation. You get a sense from the client, from the learner, of yes, this worked. No, we need to go in a different direction. Yes, let's do more of this. Let's back off this a little bit. Now, for that reason, I think it's important to understand that interpersonal relationships, therapeutic relationships, have a developmental phase, have a developmental quality to them.
This episode of Build a Brain Podcast is made possible by listeners just like you. Here on Build a Brain Podcast, we're on a mission to empower your cognitive journey, and you can be a part of it. Join our Patreon community and get early access to episodes, Q&A sessions with experts, and exclusive brain-building exercises. Support the show that supports your brain. Visit us on Patreon using the link in the show notes and become a Patreon member today. Your support makes a big difference. Thank you for being curious and for helping us build better brains. Back to the episode.
And the research literature in counseling and psychotherapy makes this clear. And I identify four phases: an attending phase, where you're making kind of building the relationship. Is it safe? Is it comfortable? Can we do some work together, and so on? And then a listening phase. Let's pay attention to what's really going on here. Let's try to understand it. In counseling terms, this is called framing. We frame the issue. What is it we're working on in the listening phase? And the listening phase can be active, can be, you know, I want to hear more about that, or, oh, this is what I think that means. And then a responding phase, based on what I've heard, based on what I've listened to, these are the kinds of things we will work on. The responding phase, then the intervening phase, where you do something, and then a terminating phase. But the important issue here is that the client has to be ready. The learner has to be ready. Mm-hmm. And we assess that readiness in an ongoing way, from attending, from the very beginning mm-hmm. on. And this is consistent with not only what we know about the development of counseling and psychotherapeutic relationships, but I really believe that and apropos of your last comment, Jeannie, I really believe that the parameters of mediated learning experience enhance that. Mm-hmm. And when I was able to build that into a training curriculum, my students began to recover their intuition. They began to feel optimistic. They began to say, okay, I can see where this is going. This is where I want to go. And parenthetically, when I brought this curriculum out to functioning counselors and therapists, they had the same feeling. It helped them to enhance what they mm-hmm. called their treatment plan, and what we would consider in the learning development field, the goals and objectives, the learning kinds of objectives. And one last comment, since I have the microphone, is that that much of this is reflected in various aspects of the instrumental enrichment program. Mm-hmm. Various stages of various instruments bring this potential out very strongly, but it is present throughout the way in which we teach instrumental enrichment lessons. When we debrief the client, when we say, how did you learn that? Where, you know, how did you do that? Are there other ways of doing it? What's new about this for you, et cetera, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. We're enhancing that interactional process. Mm-hmm. And in counseling terms, I call that accessing. The way of talking about it is getting in touch with, mm-hmm. bringing it up, bringing it out. And when the deeper issues of fears, of thoughts, of feelings, of preferences, etc., are accessed, are brought up, then and discussed and acknowledged and accepted, then you've got a therapeutic, and always remember, when I say therapeutic, I'm always talking with a small th, not therapies precise.
So when I heard you talk about attending, listening, and responding, wow, that sounds like intentionality, reciprocity, meaning, and even by the time you get to intervention, now you're talking transcendence. So those phases of the counseling process, I describe mediation as parameters that help define high quality human interaction. Mm-hmm. So when I'm training people in mediation, I tell them, you do all these things already. So I think that's what you were able to do with your trainees in psychology for to become high quality counselors, is that they now had a way to define or put a label on mm-hmm. the interaction that I'm having with my client. And sometimes we don't even know it until we're done. We walk out of a session with a client and go, wow, I saw a lot of challenge happen, or we were able to get a sense of belonging. And mm-hmm. so that's the intuitive part I see, is I can look back and put a label on it.
And that there's a very interesting anecdote. Back in the 60s, one of the approaches to teaching counseling was to take the great therapists, the Carl Rogers, the Fritz Perls, Albert Ellis's, the great therapists, ask them to do a session, record it, and then ask them to debrief it after they did their session. And then we would learn what a Rogerian does, what a Gestalt therapist does. And ultimately, that approach did not work, because when a Carl Rogers interviewed a client and then sat down afterwards to look at the tape of the client and respond. More often than not, he said, you know what? I did it, but I didn't think it worked very well. And I'm not sure why I did it. Or, oh, that really was good. Let me think for a minute about what I was hearing. In other words, And so I think that one of the great contributions that Feuerstein made in describing the parameters of mediated learning experience has been being able to see what's going on there at various aspects. And and what I've devoted my professional life to, my academic life to in the last 4 or 5 years, is to try to explicate that more fully. And that partially, the first attempt was in the book we're talking about, the Integrating Social Cognition into Therapeutic Practice. And I'm just finishing a manuscript now on taking these concepts and applying them in the same fashion to 12 different approaches to psychotherapy. In other words, if you're doing psychoanalysis, where is the MLE in it? And how does it serve as a foundation, as a platform for this? And I'm hoping that I can interest a publisher in it. It's a very competitive field, but for many years, I taught survey courses in counseling and psychotherapy and try to get a student to kind of integrate, to kind of take all the different things, make sense out of them. So I think MLE does that. One summary comment I can make on this is that in the book, I develop a schema for parallel processes in counseling. And, that schema is like a ladder.
Yes, I love the ladder.
Where the props of the ladder at the bottom are farther apart, and they get closer together when you get to the top, and they encourage the looking at the parameters of mediated learning experience, and its relationship to the what happens in the attending phase. The phases of the relationship, what are the outcomes, and MLE, I've got it in front of me as well. MLE gives us a framework for looking at how the experience of the relationship becomes more and more meaningful. In the application of instrumental enrichment, or in any other kind of mediated learning experience, you get to a point where the learner takes the lead. The learner says, I want to do this in this way, and this is how I'm learning it. And we encourage metacognition in the learner. What did it mean for you? How did you do it? How did you learn it? And so if you look at the parameters of MLE having to do with optimistic alternatives and awareness of the self as being able to change and a sense of belonging. We're talking about the learners bringing content and process together, having had interventions that are meaningful and that are restorative, just like what happens in any kind of therapeutic relationship. In a sense, and a mediated learning experience interaction, whether you're using Feuerstein tools or not, is therapeutic.
I like how the ladder starts at the bottom with intentionality, reciprocity. I have a mountain. I talk about climbing a mountain. That's funny, but kind of the same shape. And at the top of your ladder, though, because the ladder that comes closer, the sides of the ladder get closer, so it's more focused by the time you're at the top of the ladder, and the human ability to change is at the top of the ladder, and I love it. So I love your sequence on that. Let's wrap up with chapter 4, which is also powerful. And that's your chapter on all of the cognitive functions. And you did a beautiful job of defining the cognitive functions, with the idea of social cognition, or we could even say social emotional cognition. So how did that all come about, Lou? Love it.
Well, the model of social cognition, I must attribute to some wonderful discussions I had with a Feuerstein scholar from the very beginning, Mervyn Skye from South Africa.
Yeah.
We sat and we talked about this, and we said that interactions, interpersonal interactions, require a certain degree of social cognition, and that you mediate social development, and it happens developmentally from in child-parent relationships, and it happens experientially when we go to school and parenthetically. I think we're surprised at one of the consequences of the COVID isolations, and that is how important it is for children to learn in groups. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, I haven't had a chance to talk to teachers post-COVID, but I'm wondering whether students come back to the classroom with a stronger sense of the value of the interactions, the interpersonal interactions. But in any case, mm-hmm. we said, well, what are the dimensions here? And the dimensions are social affective cognition. In other words, what I know and what I learn and what I do has an interactive quality. And so there's a dichotomy between knowing, which is the awareness leading to my social cognition, and doing, how to do it. Knowing means we mediate for understanding social situations, being consistent and accurate, being able to attend to cues of what's happening socially. And it's developed as a consequence of the repertoire of cognitive functions, input level.
Yeah.
Okay. So a certain amount of mediational intervention, a certain amount of learning occurs to know. But then if we know but don't do, little happens. So mediated learning experience also must be directed toward social competence, not social awareness, but rather affective, emotional, energetic skills leading to doing. How do we function flexibly, adaptively in response to the demands of the environment and our affective reactions to it? And it leads to social behavioral responsiveness. So, mediated learning experience provides a template for looking at how to facilitate, means create, reinforce, elaborate one's awareness of oneself in the world and as a responsive and productive learner. And I think that is a good connector to this relationship of anytime I enter into a mediated learning experience interaction, it is ultimately therapeutic because we want to create the potential for the interaction and we want to create a sense of the outcomes, where we're going with it, mm-hmm. and a sense of and an experience of successful resolution, behavioral change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, your definition of the cognitive functions then help with, have I defined the problem here I'm having with my friend? You know, am I considering a viewpoint of that I want to think it's my friend's problem and maybe it's my problem? So the cognitive functions then give us those skills to use in social situations, and we get to mediate them as Feuerstein mediators, counselors, teachers, therapists, parents. And so I love what you did with those. It really helped me see them with new eyes. I've always said that you don't make friends with your big toe. You've got to use your brain. So you've got to be a thinker with why is my friend acting that way, and how can I socially interact appropriately, whether I'm in a classroom or with my friends. So I think you've given us a wonderful platform. Can't wait for your next book. because this one helped me so much with that, Lou. And any last words that you have for our listeners of Build-A-Brain?
Yes. One of the historical developments is that we have taken cognitive functions and we've moved them from the deficient focus to the positive focus. Mm-hmm. And historically, early Professor Feuerstein was criticized for describing the cognitive functions in negative terms, in deficient mm-hmm. terms. And his response at the time was, I want them to be targets for intervention. Mm-hmm. And after a few years, many of us began to say, yes, this is very important, but it's also important to encourage a positive perspective. And so we began to look at, you know, the other side of the coin. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. then in most recent years, I think the best development of our work has been to take the cognitive functions, describe them, how they show themselves in functional behavior, to look at mediational opportunities, to look at the effects they will have on the acquisition of learning skills. And so we have broadened the cognitive functions to be more feasible and usable for those of us who are working with learners.
Mm, thank you. Well said. My new word for that is a spectrum. The cognitive functions are on a spectrum.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, and you helped me develop that idea as well. I guess a lot of our conversations is what spawns some new ideas in my head. So Lou, thank you for coming on Build-A-Brain and blessing our listeners all over the world with some wonderful words of wisdom from you. And I do hope people will consider getting the book, Integrating Social Cognition into Therapeutic Practice. The subtitle is Beneath and Beyond the Process of Therapy. So thank you, Lou, and thank you, listeners.
My great pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Build a Brain podcast. If you're wanting to know more information on how to build a brain, please visit the website for the MindCap Center in Fort Wayne, Indiana at www.mind-cap.org. That's www.mind-cap.org. Children and adults from across the United States and Canada have found the cognitive help they needed at the MindCap Center. The specialized team is trained in all levels of the Feuerstein program and can literally help you or your child build a better brain. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you next time.